We've got a little Fed on the program today, a little streaming. And because it's Friday, how about we end with some love? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, April 22nd. Good to have you with us. We're going to pick up where we left the show yesterday with something Fed Chair Jay Powell said at an IMF roundtable on the global economy, which was that a half a percentage point increase in interest rates is on the table for early next month. In other words, it's going to happen. We're going to talk about that and the economic week that was with our own panelists, Heather Long, who's at The Washington Post. Gina Smilek is at The New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hi, Amy. Hey, Amy.
Heather, I'm going to start with you. This comment yesterday or comments about interest rates being on the table, no surprise there, really. But what's the significance of moving faster to raise rates than, say, a quarter point increase?
Yeah, it certainly was basically Fed Chair Powell saying, we are doing this, buckle up and get ready. But, you know, we're already seeing the ramifications of it. If you're trying to buy a home right now, you know, at the start of the year, it was 3.2% 30-year mortgage rate. Now, this week, we're up to 5.1% mortgage rates. Obviously, those are probably going to tick higher and higher in the coming weeks. And we're seeing the results of that. Mortgage demand has already fallen. Same thing with credit cards. A lot of people who are struggling financially with these higher prices that we're seeing right now, you know, they turn to credit cards to try to take on, be able to still buy more and afford gas and groceries. At the start of the year, the average last year for a credit card interest rate payment was about 16.5%. We've already seen that hit about 20% average now. So more and more of these rates in the 20%. That hurts. You know, that hurts people who are just trying to make it by. And I think the real significance of this getting more aggressive at the Fed is they're trying to make people think twice about borrowing money, but that does have some spinoff effects.
Well, right. And one risk is, of course, what happens to the job market, which Gina, the Fed chair, again said yesterday is not sustainably hot. He said this before. But, you know, we've just had another week of historically low unemployment claims. Job openings are near record highs. Is he telling us that this is about as good as it's going to get?
Yeah, I think that is more or less what the message is here. Basically, when he says unsustainably hot, that often doesn't make sense to people because, you know, a good job market sounds like just good news. But I think what he means is we're seeing such a mismatch between how many people employers want to hire and how many are actually available to be hired that we're in the situation where it's just not tenable to continue. So we're seeing very strong wage growth that's potentially going to sort of cause inflation to stay higher. And that is a problem that the Fed needs to sort of deal with. And so the idea is you slow down demand, you do all the things that Heather was just talking about, and maybe that cools off the economy enough that hiring can slow down and we won't see sort of an overheating that lasts and becomes a permanent feature of the American economy.
The elusive soft landing. So on the table is how he's signaling this. And, you know, we always hear the Fed try to communicate what it's planning to do, but leave some room for flexibility. I'm curious, Heather, how you think the Fed is trying to communicate what's about to happen. And do you think it's working?
Well, they've certainly gotten their message a lot better than it was last year when they kept telling people that it'll get better soon and these sort of that it's just transitory, that dreaded transitory word that they've, quote, retired now.
That has been banished,
but,
yeah.
Yes, basically banished. But, you know, I know Gina has some thoughts on this, too, that you still have so many questions in the from American consumers. They're very pessimistic about this economy that they're living through. They can quote the last gas price they paid. I can quote the one I paid, $3.93. I was just glad it was under $4. And the number one question I think people keep asking is, when will it end? And the Fed is smart enough now not to give a definitive answer, not to try to really pin that down. But it just creates this aura of, are they really in control? Can they really handle this situation? So it's sort of this tricky path to walk. The other thing I would say that's really hard for the Fed is Gina was just outlining, you know, all the tools they have impact the demand side. And a huge part of what's driving the problems in the economy right now are the supply side. You know, we can't get those couches or those waffle irons for months. There aren't enough homes for sale, and there aren't enough baby formula on the shelves for various reasons. Mm-hmm. But the Fed can't really do much about that. They can't start making baby formula and waffle irons in the basement of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, there is only so much the Fed can do. And, you know, we heard that this is a global problem, that one of the interesting things about this forum was that, it, you know, the European Central Bank president, Christine Lagarde, was there, IMF managing director, Kristalina Georgieva, and Indonesia's minister of finance. I think Sarah Eisen, who was moderating this from the CNBC, said it was the most powerful women in the economy. And Chair Powell. Gina, anything else stand out to you about that discussion of the global economy and the pressures, you know, only added to this situation by the war in Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things we're really seeing happen here that is really interesting to watch is that these inflation pressures are really global. And so all of these various officials are talking quite a bit about how they're going to deal with these pressures in their own economies. And for, you know, for the ECB, they're taking it much, the European Central Bank, they're taking it much more slowly in Europe. Here, we're obviously being much more aggressive and responding to these price pressures because we don't have quite as much of an economic impact from Ukraine. And most of the impact is going to be through those price channels as we see really gas cost a lot more in particular. And so just a world-spanning problem, but really with sort of a unique inflation impact here in the U.S.
Heather, beyond what the Fed can do about inflation, today Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen addressed the role of tariffs in consumer prices, saying on Bloomberg TV that lowering U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods would have desirable effects on inflation, and that's under consideration. Do you think that would make much of a difference?
It would definitely make a difference. I think there's been a lot of head scratching when President Biden comes out and sort of keeps saying this message of I'm trying to do everything I can to keep these prices under control, that there's two really obvious things from an economic point of view that he can do that the White House really hasn't done much on. Number one is what you were just talking about, lowering tariffs, particularly the ones that former President Trump put in place on China. I know, Amy, you've reported on that study by the Peterson Institute that came out a few weeks ago that suggested that inflation could be more than a percentage point lower. You know, that's a pretty big deal if the U.S. rolled back quite a few of the tariffs that are currently in place. And I would also say the other big one they could do that I'm surprised they're not doing more of is immigration. You know, yes, we have a lot of issues at the southern border, but I'm talking about legal immigration. You know, there's a huge backlog in processing, and these are people who could work, who want to work in some cases, and they can't do it because they're literally stuck in this bureaucratic paperwork mess. And again, it's just you sit there and think, why aren't you taking some of these actions?
All right. Well, we have to leave it there for now. Great to have both of you on. Heather Long is at The Washington Post. Gina Smilek with The New York Times. Thanks so much and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Amy.
Thanks, Amy.
On Wall Street today, not a whole lot of optimism. We'll have details when we do the numbers. France goes to the polls this Sunday in the second and last round of its presidential election. The incumbent, Emmanuel Macron, seems likely to win a second term, but his challenger, Marine Le Pen of the hard-right National Rally Party, has performed better than expected. At one point in the campaign, she was just 3 percentage points behind the president. A cost-of-living crisis in France has boosted her campaign. It's a critical election for Europe, which has seen a rise in far-right ideology. From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
Macron's re-election should have been a shoo-in. He's cut unemployment and restored the French economy to pre-pandemic levels. But as political analyst Romain Pasquier told the BBC, Macron's also acquired an unhelpful image.
There is an expression in French that nowadays Emmanuel Macron is le président des riches, the president of the rich.
His pro-business reforms, his plan to raise the retirement age to 64, and his aloof manner have apparently alienated many voters. Marine for president, shout Marine Le Pen supporters at this recent rally. She has taken an entirely different tack from Macron.
She's changed her main issue into purchasing power, into spending power, into buying power.
Douglas Yates of the American Graduate School in Paris says Le Pen has focused laser-like on the cost of living crisis.
She wants to create basic wage increases. She wants to get rid of the sales tax on fuel, which is something that hits poor people in their pocketbook the most.
She wants to lower the retirement age for people who start work young. In a successful bid to attract youthful voters, she's promised to scrap income tax for everyone under 30, and she's softened her hardline image.
To make herself seem nicer, like someone who wants to take care of you, who's concerned with the people.
But the hardline policies remain. She's still calling for a deep cut in immigration and a ban on wearing the Muslim headscarf in public. She's pro-Russian, anti-NATO and anti-EU.
It would be hugely problematic for the EU if it had to deal with President Le Pen.
Ian Bond of the Centre for European Reform says Le Pen may have ditched her plan to pull France out of the euro, but she's still intent on blocking and hindering the union.
That's unlikely to be to France's economic benefit. France is actually an economy which is highly integrated into the European economy.
At their last rally before Sunday's vote, members of Le Pen's party chanted, "We're going to win." Opinion polls suggest they won't, this time at least. But against a background of economic malaise, low pay and job insecurity, some analysts say there could be an extreme right-wing government in power in France after the next presidential election in 5 years. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It's been an interesting week in the streaming business. First, that big drop in paid Netflix subscriptions that sent the company's stock plunging and took some others down with it. Then yesterday, CNN dropped the news that it's pulling the plug on CNN Plus, the streaming platform it launched less than a month ago. All this has inspired a lot of talk about whether we've reached peak streaming. But news is a different beast. And as Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes reports, the industry has lost an opportunity to find out what the future could look like.
This week, futurist Amy Webb felt like she'd been transported back to 1996.
This moment in time reminds me a little bit of the early days of the internet when newspapers grappled with whether or not to erect a paywall.
Webb, who leads the Future Today Institute, says television news is now in the same boat of having to navigate the transition from audiences raised on cable to audiences raised on TikTok.
Gen Z, Gen Alpha, they have vastly different expectations for media. And what constitutes news for them is unrecognized by the people who are making these new news apps.
CNN Plus offered a chance to figure out what that audience wants. Brian Weezer is with the company Group M, which buys advertising time for its clients from media companies, including CNN.
I'm a proponent of the spaghetti theory of programming. You know, throw enough against the wall and some percentage of it will stick. So you don't really know exactly what would have stuck in the case of CNN Plus.
Some other media companies are experimenting. ABC News, for example, is streaming coverage that doesn't make it on the air. And Jessica Reif-Ehrlich, the senior media and entertainment analyst at Bank of America, says streaming news is working elsewhere.
Discovery Plus launched last year, and they are one of the strongest news organizations in areas like Poland.
What isn't likely to work is just replicating the same kind of content that's on cable. Mike Anani is a professor of communication and journalism at the University of Southern California. He says news organizations have to ask some pretty fundamental questions.
You know, what does it mean for news to circulate and travel on Twitter versus on Facebook versus Snapchat versus TikTok? Every new platform that comes along, news organizations have to figure out what it means to translate their work into the language of those platforms.
And into the language of future platforms that we can't even imagine right now. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace. Coming up,
I love talking about relationships.
Everyone has their thing, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 981 points, 2.8%, to finish at 33,811. The NASDAQ dropped 335 points, 2.5%, and to 12,839. And the S&P 500 lost 121 points, 2.75%, to land at 4,271. For the week, the Dow was down 1.8%, the NASDAQ shed 3.8%, the S&P fell 2.75%. Verizon unplugged nearly 6% after a disappointing earnings report. This may sound familiar, they lost subscribers. Lots of airline news this week. A couple of airlines, American and United, said in their quarterly results this week they expect to return to profitability this year. So, taxiing over to United, that soared up 1.1%. American descended about 0.2%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. On this day, April 22nd, in 1970, millions of Americans took to the streets for the first Earth Day. The day of marches and community cleanups and teach-ins was inspired in part by a massive oil spill off the coast of California. The push for cleaner energy sources has come a long way since then. The Pew Research Center says about 70% of Americans support prioritizing alternative energy, such as wind and solar. And with the Russian invasion of Ukraine causing oil and natural gas prices to soar recently, though oil has softened a bit this week, you'd think alternatives would get a boost. But as Marketplace's Matt Levin reports, the renewables industry is facing its own economic challenges.
Crude oil is over $100 a barrel. Nobody wants to pay Vladimir Putin for gas anymore. And 3/4 of Americans now think that, yeah, climate change is at least partially caused by humans. Great time for the solar energy business, right?
This has been an incredibly frustrating couple of months in the solar industry.
Abby Hopper is head of the Solar Energy Industries Association. The Commerce Department is looking into whether solar panels imported from Southeast Asia have ties to Beijing and therefore need retroactive tariffs.
Panels that you purchased and are even maybe shipping to the United States as we speak, you now don't know what they're going to cost when they get here.
Hopper says the U.S.-China trade war is causing solar projects to get delayed or canceled. Wind power is also vulnerable to global supply chain problems, says Greg Whetstone with the American Council on Renewable Energy.
A wind turbine is a really complex apparatus with thousands and thousands of parts. Some of those parts are not manufactured here.
Those parts could be stuck in Chinese ports locked down because of COVID, you know, right next to the furniture you ordered back in February. Whetstone says a more persistent issue is a lack of infrastructure connecting wind farms to transmission lines.
The financing is ready. The siting is ready. It's all put together, and we can't get that power on the grid.
John Kotek with the Nuclear Energy Institute says rising energy prices have renewed interest in new nuclear tech, especially in Europe.
One iron and steel company in Poland is working with U.S. small modular reactor developers to bring their technology to help decarbonize their supply.
Of course, those images of a Ukrainian nuclear power plant on fire probably won't make Americans feel more comfortable with the idea. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
We We have talked before on the program about the big increase recently in entrepreneurship. Applications for new businesses reached nearly 5.5 million last year, a record, according to the census. For today's installment of our series, My Economy, we're going to turn to one of those businesses created in the early days of the pandemic, back when a lot of us were stuck at home, glued to our phones.
My name is Livia Atwood. I live in LA newly, and I am a matchmaker. I started a company called Liv's Love Pool during the pandemic. It started as a complete accident. I just posted something on Instagram that I thought was basically a joke, very in the vein of the other like really popular thing that was happening at the time was Love is Blind. And so I posted it like that, being like, do you want to go on a blind phone call date, like from the comfort of your home? You know, DM me 3 facts about yourself. And then I just got so many DMs. Now it's been 2 years. The pool is about 2,000 people strong now. There are several big differences that have occurred in the business. First of all, like, you're not messaging me on Instagram. I now have an actual system. When I was doing it on Instagram, it was obviously absolutely free. Now we're working on rolling out kind of different tiers of payments, because this base level is just $10 for 3 phone calls. But in terms of how I'm matching people, it's still 3 facts and an annoying habit. But other than that, we're really going off of gut and intuition. People were surprised that I am an entrepreneur, because I am not a business-minded person. The matchmaking part, it's always been in the works. I love talking about relationships more than anything. The entire Bachelor franchise is like my literal kryptonite. And so it's kind of crazy that all of these things came together to become a business that I run. But another reason that this launched for me is when COVID started, I was laid off of all 6 of my jobs. Just boom, 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 just down the line, every position that I had. One of the funnest parts of my job that I created for myself is reading all of these bios that people send me and getting to talk to these people after I make matches. I have 6 couples that are about to hit or just hit their 2-year anniversary. My favorite couple, I feel bad about all the other couples, but I just think their love story is really crazy. The girl was in Minnesota and the boy was in Austria. They pretty much fell in love over the phone with an ocean between them, and they moved in together effectively sight unseen in France. I was so nervous when this was happening, because what if one of them smells weird? What if she doesn't like how he chews? But it's been 2 years, things are going swimmingly, and they say that they're the loves of each other's lives, which is like so beautiful.
Oh, Olivia Atwood, you just got to root for her, right? She's the founder of Liv's Love Pool, lives in Los Angeles. And hey, why don't you tell us what's going on in your personal economy? There's a place you can do that. Marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today. Every now and then I think about joining the whole air fryer trend. I mean, who doesn't like crispy everything, but without all the fat? Today, though, I'm thinking, nah. The Washington Post reports that Best Buy is recalling more than 750,000 of its Insignia brand air fryers and air fryer ovens, which I guess are different. Anyway, the recall comes after more than 100 reports of the devices burning, melting, or catching fire. The Consumer Product Safety Commission says the models cost between $30 and $150 and can be returned to Best Buy for, get this, store credit. And here's your moment of economic context for this Friday. We told you yesterday that the FAA is making its zero tolerance policy for unruly airline passengers permanent. Something we didn't tell you, Delta, American, and United will allow some passengers they previously banned due to mask violations to fly again. Of the 1,200 complaints about behavior to the FAA so far this year, nearly 65% were mask-related. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fergali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Amy Scott. Have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.